From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. In a case where five people lost their lives, and a man was sent to prison for the rest of his, one would hope that the police would have investigated every angle, left no stone unturned. You would hope that the detectives in charge would do everything in their power to make sure that these victims received justice, and that the monster who took their lives was locked away forever. But one of the first things that really stood out to me when I began reading into this case was the complete void of conclusive evidence pointing to Chris Bynum. There were lots of fingerprints and DNA profiles found on the scene, but none of them matched Chris. Last week, you heard evidence that most of the bullets recovered at both scenes were fired from the same gun, but there's zero evidence they came from a gun that Chris owned or even used. Nor is there any evidence that he ever even possessed such a gun. Now, to be fair, there is that confession, but any 8th grader could figure out in 10 minutes that the details of the confession don't fit the crime scene evidence at all. So how did this happen? How could a man with no connection to the victims, who left no biological evidence on either scene, with no history of violence and no access to a 38 caliber pistol, get convicted and sent to prison for the rest of his life? The answer lies in the testimony of a 12-year-old little boy. A 5th grader. Right away, that detail stood out to me as a big problem. Not because Larry Brooks is unreliable or a bad kid or known to be untrustworthy. Simply because a 12-year-old, any 12-year-old, particularly one who has been horribly traumatized and lost his entire support system in the process, is going to be vulnerable and highly suggestible. And Larry Brooks is a perfect example of that. Throughout the course of today's episode, I'm going to walk you through the many different versions of Larry's story, beginning with the reports from the first arriving officers, the first people to speak with Brooks on the night his mother, aunt, and his mother's boyfriend were murdered just feet away from him. Several weeks ago, I introduced you to Larry Brooks and a bit of his trial testimony. We're going to move through all of Larry's statements now in chronological order using original source documents where we can. And we're going to begin with the official written report from the second officer on the scene on the night of the murders, Corporal Dame. Dame arrived just a minute or so after Officer Trevino, and according to Trevino's testimony, Dame took over the scene as the ranking officer pretty quickly thereafter. I'm going to read to you directly from Dame's report the parts that are relevant to Larry Brooks. Paragraph 6 reads as follows. Quote, according to Larry Brooks, he had heard two subjects with voices that he described as male blacks talking in the living room. He then heard several gunshots. When he looked out of his bedroom where he was laying down, he found the victims on the floor and called 911. End quote. And then paragraph 12 reads, Larry Brooks claims that he did not see the subject or subjects responsible and did not recognize the voices. End quote. I've read you that report before, but I think it's worth repeating because it establishes our baseline for Larry. Right there, at the scene, minutes after the murders, Larry told Corporal Dame that he, quote, did not see the subject or subjects responsible and did not recognize the voices. End quote. But Dame wasn't the only officer to write a report about Larry that night. This next one is one that wasn't in the police file that I received on the case, but it was included in the appeals documents. Detective Moxley was dispatched to the scene at 2:32 a.m., and when he arrived, Dame and Trevino were both still there. Moxley never spoke directly to Larry at the scene, but he did speak to Officer Trevino. Remember, Trevino was the very first officer to get there and the first one to have contact with Larry. And Moxley documented that conversation in his report. Remember, we don't have a report from Trevino himself, only his trial testimony. But as I said, Trevino was the first one to make contact with Larry, so it's worth noting what he told Moxley. From his report, quote, Corporal Jeff Trevino was also on the scene. He had informed me that the 12-year-old son was in the back bedroom and heard what he believed to be two male black voices. The son called the police after he had heard the shots and went into the front room and saw the bodies on the floor. He also said that the juvenile said that he did not see anything. End quote. So there's our baseline, duly noted. Minutes after the murders, Larry spoke with Officer Dame, who we hear from directly through his report, and Dame is very clear. Larry didn't see anyone, and he did not recognize the voices. The other officer to speak directly to Larry that night was Officer Trevino, who relayed that conversation to Detective Moxley, and Moxley reports that Dame told him that Larry, quote, did not see anything, end quote. So at this point, all we have to move the investigation forward is a traumatized little boy who heard people talking, then heard gunshots, then called 911, and went into the living room to find his family murdered. But things changed really, really quickly. When Moxley arrived on the scene, Larry and little Katrina were sitting in the back of Corporal Dame's patrol car. Shortly thereafter, their grandmother showed up and took them both home with her. They spent a couple hours at Grandma's house before an officer showed up and took Larry to the police station to get a statement from him. Now, if you go onto our website and read the statement, you'll see that it's a transcript. But there's an important distinction to note between this transcript and the transcripts that we're used to reading. Generally, these documents are created based on a recorded interview. Police record every word that's said, and then after the fact, the audio is transcribed. Which is a good system, because if you have any concerns about credibility of the transcripts, you can always go back and listen to the original audio. But in this case, and I mean this entire case, nothing was recorded. The transcripts were created in real time, usually one officer doing the questioning while another types up what's being said. In this instance, according to the report, Detective Moxley did the questioning and the typing all by himself. Now, obviously, this process leaves room for honest mistakes, but it also leaves a lot of room for not-so-honest mistakes. With that being said, let me read to you the relevant portions of the transcript. Again, the entire document is posted on our website if you want to read it. Now, before I get started, remember, just a couple hours earlier, Larry told both officers that he didn't see anyone and he didn't recognize any voices. Just to remind you of the context, Larry was in the fifth grade when he gave this statement. After getting all the basic info out of the way, Moxley asked Larry to tell him what he saw and heard that night. And here's Larry's response, quote, These two men came to my house and they were arguing with Anthony Jeffers. They were talking about how they were going to kill them. And they were talking about how they had 3 minutes to shut up and then they left. Anthony Jeffers was on the telephone after that telling somebody that they had a gun waving it around with the hammer back. I heard my auntie answer the door about an hour later, and one of the guys told her to sit down. And then that was it. They just started shooting. After they started shooting, they said, put another shell in. And then the other man said, don't rush me, I know what I'm doing. One of the guys said, shoot her in the head. And then the other guy said, turn off the lights, turn off the lights. Then he said, let's dip before the law comes. End quote. Now, just a little bit of input from me and my own personal opinion about the transcript there. Again, this is supposed to be a transcript. It's supposed to be the exact words. And the first sentence here jumps out at me as something that Larry wouldn't say. And that's the fact that he said that the men came in the house and were arguing with Anthony Jeffers. I have to believe that if Larry was answering that question, he would have just said that they were arguing with Amp or with Anthony. Just don't think that he would use the full name like that. But anyway, moving on. After that, there's more back and forth, and I'll just read it to you right from the transcript. Remember, on that very same morning, Larry said that he didn't recognize any voices and didn't see anything. I should also point out that by this point, Chris Bynum was already being targeted by Moxley and his team. From the transcript, quote, Did you see the men the first or second time that they came to the house? the second time. Did you know the men that came to the house the second time? It was the same two men that came the first. Did you know either of the men? I know one of them. What is the name of the man that you recognized? Chris. You know his last name? No. How do you know Chris? I seen him before and I know his voice. Where have you seen Chris before? Driving a brown car up and down my street? If you were to see a picture of him, do you think you could point him out? Yes. You said that you saw them the second time. Did you see who had the gun? Yes. Did this man named Chris ever come over to your house? Yes. Why did he come to your house before? To talk to Anthony. Do you know what they were talking about? No. When was the last time that Chris was at your house other than that night? 3 weeks ago. Why are you so sure it's 3 weeks ago? I'd got an A in math, and it was about the 28th or 29th of January. End quote. Now, did you notice the abrupt transition here? There was no back and forth between that first chunk that I read to you and this second chunk that I read to you. One came right after the other. So Larry supposedly gave this long narrative about what happened, and in that narrative, all he says is that he heard Angela answer the door. She's told to sit down and the shooting starts. And then the very next question is, did you see the men the first or the second time they came to the house? Now, Larry had never to this point said that he ever saw the men. In fact, he had specifically stated that he didn't see anything. Seems like kind of a strange follow-up, doesn't it? In any case, the conversation quickly moves from he heard the voices to he knows one of the killers was a man named Chris. And for me, the suspicious nature of this transcript just kept growing when I read that Larry, the fifth grader, in mid-conversation on the 17th of February, knows that the last time Chris had come to the house to talk to Anthony was 3 weeks ago because he knew it was on the 28th or 29th of January, and he knows that was 3 weeks ago because he got an A in math. Now, how many of you adults just had to count on your fingers to figure out if he was right? Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. I mentioned in last week's follow-up that there's some evidence that Amp was a drug dealer. Well, this is the evidence. According to this transcript, Larry told Moxley that Amp was dealing. Quote, did Anthony sell drugs? Yes, he did sell drugs. Did a lot of people come to the house often? Yes. Was it to buy drugs? Yes. Did anyone else in the house sell drugs besides Anthony? No. How long has he been selling drugs out of the house? like 7 years, end quote. I need to be clear here that so far I haven't seen a shred of evidence to support the fact that Amp was a dealer, just this statement. As the questioning goes on, Larry says that Chris comes by about once a month, and the thing he said that caused him to recognize his voice was, quote, put another shell in, shoot her in the head. He said that he's sure that it was Chris's voice who said that. Now, listen to this part and compare it to the evidence we have so far. Larry is asking what kind of drugs Anthony sold, and he says heroin. And he knows it was heroin that he was using and selling because he recognized the smell. He says that it smells like sour milk. Now, just to remind you, there was no heroin in anyone's system in that house. There was no heroin found anywhere in the house. And according to Tasha, Amp's drug of choice was cocaine, not heroin. So just store that away for a rainy day. As the transcript goes on, Larry eventually gives a detailed description of Chris. Quote, he's tall, like 6 foot. He has a gap between his teeth. He always has a hat on. He's slim build. He talks hip hop all the time. End quote. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, he has a slim build and talks hip hop all the time sounds a lot more like an out of touch adult cop's words than a fifth grader's. And not for nothing, but since Larry supposedly gave this detailed description of the Chris that he's familiar with here, you might want to take a minute and go to our website and check out the picture I posted of Chris Bynum from around the time of the murders. He's holding his baby and has a big cheesing grin on his face, and spoiler alert, Chris has a great smile and great teeth, and he does not have a gap in his teeth. The transcript gets less and less believable as you continue on. We get the same story from Larry that we also get from Willie. Liz lied to Chris and told him that Anthony was talking shit about him, and that's why Chris came to the house waving the gun around and ultimately killed everyone in the house. Oh, and Larry also knows that Chris was about 24 years old because he and Angela discussed that while he was pointing the gun at Amp. Quote, how old do you think Chris is? 24, because he said that last night and he was trying to talk to my auntie, Angela Wallace, and he asked her how old she was and she said 24, and he said, that's how old I am too, end quote. Now, despite how ridiculous that is in general, I just want to point out again that Larry here says that he was trying to talk to, quote, my auntie, Angela Wallace. Now, again, he's a fifth grader, he's 12 years old, and he actually knew his aunt by Renee. So I don't think there's any way he would say my auntie, Angela Wallace. In any case, there it is, there you have it. The first few hours of evolution after the murders. According to Detective Moxley, Larry first saw nothing, just heard two voices and didn't recognize them. And then he knows that it was Chris. He says in the transcript that he can't remember his last name, but it starts with a B. He heard a conversation about how old he is. He knows what the argument was about. He saw Chris and recognized his voice. In short, it was definitely Chris who did it. And again, that evolution took place in a matter of just a few hours. Then the next version of the story that we hear is from the trial. Before I get into the transcript, let's just do a quick little recap. Statement number one, given to Trevino minutes after the murders and relayed through Moxley's report. Larry didn't see anything. Statement number two, given to Dame in a more formal interview on the scene within an hour of the murders. Larry heard two male black voices, he didn't recognize them, didn't see anyone, and has no idea who's responsible for the murders. Then we move on to the beginning of statement number three as transcribed by Moxley at the police station a few hours later. Larry heard voices, then he later heard Angela answer the door, he heard a man tell her to sit down, then the shooting started, and he heard them say to reload and turn off the lights as they left. By the end of the third statement, we get, I saw Chris, whose last name starts with a B, in the house, and I know him because he comes by the house once a month to talk to Amp, and I recognize his voice when he said to reload the guns and turn off the lights. And then, for statement number four, Larry Brooks was put on the stand to tell his story in front of a jury. We went through most of his testimony several weeks ago, so I'm only going to focus today on the parts relating to the actual events on the night of the murders. Larry says in his testimony that his bedtime is 9 o'clock, and that's when he went to his room, but he was allowed to watch TV in there until he fell asleep, which is what he was doing that night. He says that he fell asleep, and this is what happened next. From the transcript, quote, "I woke up by arguing. And tell me about this arguing. Could you tell who was arguing, or what did you do? Well, I had woke up, and I heard the arguing, and then I just got scared and sitting in my bed. Why were you scared? Because I didn't know what was going to happen. Could you hear voices? Yes. Who were the voices that you could hear? Anthony Jeffers and my mom, and Renee was screaming. Renee was screaming? Could you hear anybody else in the house? Yes. Who else did you hear? Chris Bynum." End quote. Now, imagine you're a juror and you just heard that. No question, no hesitation, nothing but absolute certainty. Amp and my aunt were screaming and I heard Chris Bynum's voice. That right there was pretty much checkmate for Chris. In this version, Larry says that he couldn't hear what the argument was about. He just heard what he called hollering. He goes on to say again that the voice he heard was that of, this time he says, Christopher Bynum. Then the prosecutor asked Larry if he could point out to the jury where Chris Bynum was in the courtroom. And of course, he ported right at him. And if it wasn't so tragic, it would be kind of cute that when asked to describe what Chris was wearing in the courtroom, Larry said that he was right there on the left, wearing a tuxedo. Larry goes on to say that Chris Bynum, always the full name, was arguing with his family for 15 to 20 minutes. Collins, the prosecutor, gets Larry to say Chris Bynum's full name over and over and over again throughout his testimony. Quote, "And who again? Tell me again who all's in the house at this time?" And every time we get the full name. My mother, Angela, Anthony, Katrina, and Chris Bynum. And it gets a little confusing while you're reading in the transcript, but this entire description he's giving here is of the first visit by the two men. Larry says that he fell back asleep before the men left. Then he says that he overhears Amp talking to his brother Willie on the phone. And after the phone call, Larry falls back asleep again. He says in his testimony, and I should point out that this is the first instance where we know we're reading Larry's actual words. And here, Larry says that he was asleep, and the sound of gunshots is what woke him up. Not arguing, not Angela opening the door. He says he was asleep, and then he heard the loud banging noises. Collins tries to get him to say that he heard voices first, but Graddick, Chris's attorney, shuts her down. Quote, "Did you hear any voices in the house when you were hearing these gunshots?" Graddick, "I don't believe there was any testimony about hearing gunshots." End quote. Now, he didn't officially object, but the objection would have been leading the witness. Larry said what he said. You can't just insert a leading narrative into a witness's testimony. Collins, she just moved past it and asked if there were any voices after the shots, since Larry hadn't made it that far yet. And again, we get the full name. Chris Bynum said something about putting another shell in. Then Larry says the other guy said, "Don't rush me, I know what I'm doing." And Chris said, "Shoot her in the head." Then Chris told the other guy to turn the lights off, and they left. I can't imagine at this point that there are any of you listening who would disagree with me. Larry Brooks' testimony not only is unreliable, but almost has to have been influenced by at least the police, if not the prosecutor. You don't go from not seeing anything and not recognizing any voices to knowing with absolute certainty that it was Chris Bynum who committed the murders. It's just not possible. And we also get a few clues as to what was going on when we really dig into the alleged transcript of Larry's first police interview. For example, when Moxley asked him what Chris's last name was, and Larry says he doesn't know, but it starts with a B. It feels a lot like he was told the name before the interview, and he couldn't remember it. It was also the second time that Moxley prompted him for the last name. The first time he just said he didn't know it. The second time he said he didn't know it, but it starts with a B. I could go on and on about what I think happened in that interview, but rather than rely on my analysis, let's just see what the adult version of Larry Brooks had to say. During Chris's appeal process, his attorney called Larry in for a deposition. For those of you who don't know, a deposition is very similar to court testimony. The witness is under oath and they're questioned by attorneys. Larry's deposition transcript, an actual transcript created from the actual words that were said in the deposition, is posted on our website in its entirety. It's a good read, but it's too long for me to go through all of it here in this episode. If you read it, I think you'll have the same feeling I did. This is one of the most disgusting things I've ever even heard about a police officer doing. Larry Brooks was just 12 years old. He was in the fifth grade. He had just been woken out of a dead sleep to the sound of gunshots and walked out of his bedroom to find his mother, aunt, and his mother's boyfriend shot to death in his living room. He was traumatized, horrified, and scared to death. And instead of protecting him or even making an effort to find the monsters who did this, the detectives manipulated a grieving child to close their case. The deposition begins with Larry reading the transcript from that first interview, the one we have posted on our website. It was the one that was conducted and typed up by Moxley on the day of the murders. This deposition from this transcript took place in the year 2020, and Larry is 33 years old at this point. And when you read the transcript, you'll see he is indignant. He just keeps saying over and over again that he never said most of these things. In particular, he keeps circling back to the fact that Amp sold heroin and that he knew it was heroin because it smelled like spoiled milk. I'm paraphrasing, but Larry basically says that's complete bullshit. As far as he knew, Amp never sold drugs or did heroin, and he would have no idea what heroin smelled like. He said that he knew his mom and Amp would smoke marijuana occasionally, but that was it. That's all he knew about. He insists that there is no way in hell he would have ever said that Amp sold drugs or shot up heroin. So there's big problem number one. According to Larry, this is far worse than coercion. It's a straight-up lie. He says that what Moxley typed into that transcript, words that he claims Larry said that night, were a complete fabrication, which also tells you a lot about how much Moxley actually cared about these victims. Not only did he use Larry to cut corners and close the case, but he vilified Amp in the process. According to Larry, there are parts of the transcript that he thinks he did say. Most importantly, he did tell Moxley in that interview that it was Chris's voice he heard, but not because he recognized the voice. He said it because before the interview, Moxley told him that they already knew it was Chris Bynum and that he had already confessed to the murders. This exchange from the transcript pretty much sums up where Larry's statements about Chris came from. From the transcript. The attorney here is asking about Larry's first interaction with police, his interview with Corporal Dame on the scene that night. Quote, "Do you remember telling them that you couldn't identify anybody?" "Yeah, I remember I told them I didn't see no faces. It's in this one. I didn't see no faces." "So you didn't see Chris Bynum's face?" "Not that I remember, no." "And you didn't hear his voice?" "I don't remember, no." "And so if you said to the jury that it was Chris Bynum, that would not be accurate?" "That was because they told me who confessed to doing it." "So when you said it was Chris Bynum, that was impacted by them telling you he confessed?" "Yes." "That's what made you believe it?" "Well, I was 13. You're not going to, you know what I'm saying?" "Yeah, I do. That's why I need you to explain it as much as you can for the lady that's typing it." "Okay, yeah, I was 13. I mean, you're not going to go against what an adult says, especially a police officer. So I was just doing what I was told. And it wasn't from something you knew to be, other than what they were telling you. So if you had to do it over again, I wouldn't do it over again. End quote. Here's the bottom line. Larry didn't know Chris Bynum. Larry didn't see Chris Bynum on the night of the murders. Larry didn't hear Chris Bynum on the night of the murders. In fact, just like he told Dame in the very beginning, he didn't see anything and didn't hear any voices that he recognized on that night. Everything that he knew about Chris Bynum came from the police. Now, if you read the full transcript, you'll see that Larry was aware of a Chris that would come by and talk to Amp on occasion. But if you really pay attention, you'll see that he doesn't know that Chris to be Chris Bynum. The only connection to a guy named Chris that used to come around and was friends with Amp and our Chris Bynum, was Larry's identification of Bynum in court during the trial. Remember, the prosecutor asked him to point out the Chris that came around the house occasionally, the one whose voice Larry supposedly recognized on the night of the murder. And Larry pointed right at Bynum, the guy there on the left wearing the tuxedo. But in his deposition, Larry explains exactly how he was able to do that. From the transcript. Quote, "Did there ever come a time when your identification of Chris Bynum at trial weighed on you in some way? As far as like, where do you know who they're pointing at? Yeah, tell us about that. Because before I went in there, he was like, Chris Bynum, he's sitting right there inside. I do remember that. Who said that? I think it was, somebody said it before I went in to go testify. So somebody, before you went to testify, told you he confessed, is that right? Do you remember how many times they told you that? Couple times. And somebody actually pointed out to you where he was. End quote. Larry Brooks' testimony at trial was devastating to Chris. He told the jury that he knew his name, knew what he sounded like, knew what he looked like, and he pointed right at him without a moment's hesitation. The state could have ended their case right then and there, and Chris would have been convicted without even a shadow of a doubt. And now, 24 years later, Chris Bynum remains behind bars because closing a case and getting a conviction proved to be more important than protecting a 12-year-old child and bringing his family's actual killers to justice. Larry Brooks is just one of many victims in this case. He was abused and manipulated, and because of that, his mother's killer walked free. The entirety of his involvement in this case can be concisely summed up in his own words. Quote, "I was just doing what I was told." Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.